If you're an athlete, you know the greatest motivator of all is the fear of letting your teammates down. After all, a team is only as good as its weakest link. So you owe it to those wearing the same jersey as you to be your best every time you step on the field. That's why there's no vape in team. When you vape, you can expose your lungs to toxic chemicals that can damage your lungs. If you're a step behind, the team's a step behind. Brought to you by The Real Cost and the FDA.
Ian, are you ready for a bearded, completely unnecessary podcast for Wednesday, back on Wednesday, April 12th, 2017? We're both hairy and straggly beard and looking long in the tooth. It's time to retire almost. Yeah. Ian, how you doing?
I'm okay.
We're going to be talking about some other stuff on this show besides Ian's failing health. We're talking about the YouTube ad controversy, advertiser controversy, and a follow-up. We're also be talking about the 20-year anniversary of Nesticle. I can't believe that. Well, we're talking about Nintendo Direct, maybe a scumbag seller of the week, maybe other topics that Ian will be around for. We'll see. Mm. And maybe a Q&A I'll probably do by myself. So, Ian, what's been going on besides you being okay?
I had a really bad sinus cold over the weekend.
Oh, okay. Well, there you go.
You know, on top of...
Ian pity party time.
No, I mean... Yeah, it's just one of those things. I did my taxes.
Oh, I'm waiting to get that back from my tax guy, Murray. I'm waiting on that. That's going to be a fun time.
Holy shit, did I get hosed.
Hey, you know what the deal is.
No, it was, you know, I had the money set aside and then... sickness came and all that money went away.
Well, you can always prepay too during the year. You can send money to the IRS website.
Yeah, no, it's not so bad.
Mine's gonna be bad. I was like, oh, I got this much money, I can do this with this. And I'm like, nope, I gotta wait a little bit now. That's okay.
Unfortunately, I had to cancel the trip to Retrospillmessen. So
in Norway.
Yeah, so that's sad.
Aww. I'll be there though, and I'll be there. What is that, May 19th? What is it? Keep going.
But I've been playing a lot of MLB The Show. This has been my new distraction when I'm sick and I can't do anything on the days off. As I play online leagues with my buddies, and I lost straight across the board with the Blue Jays.
Why the Blue Jays?
Because they're from Toronto, and I like their logo.
Of course, you have to choose the only Canadian team. You gotta do that to our pastime. Retrospillmessen is May 20th to 21st, and Sandefjord, Norway. I am returning. I'll be there with guys like. Norman Caruso, the gaming historian. I think Brennelfoss will be there. Gerard the Completionist will be there.
Jay will be there.
Jay from the Game Chasers will be there. That's right. He's returning. It'll be fine. It'll be fun. It's a great time if you're in the Norwegian area or the greater, I guess, Scandinavian area. Check it out. You know, retrospillmessen.no. And new Flea Market Madness is out. I still have a lot in the can. I'm dreading editing them just to see, like, the fines just, you know, just evaporate month by month. It's been very interesting.
Oh, I forgot the one major announcement that I wanted to make. Pat and I are starting a cooking show.
I don't know if that's official or not. you do have your own YouTube channel. We can do that.
I just wanted to see your face right after you said you have a lot in the pipeline.
We can do that. We can have one stationary camera and then one for covers and one person following us.
Vonnie thinks it would be the most adorable thing in the world.
Adorable? Sure. That's one word you can use to describe it if you could. Ian, have you heard about the Not So Common podcast with Pat Contry?
I have. I'm waiting to be invited.
You really want to be on, interviewed on the second? We can talk about your times growing up in Buffalo, going to high school.
Yeah.
I almost said waitressing days. Your waiting days.
You're waitressing, that's fine, too.
In Buffalo. And believe it or not, Ian, the Ultimate Game Guide for NES app is updated to 1.2 now for both Android and iOS. Which means it's just about where I want it to be. So go to droid.ultimatenes.com for Android or ios.ultimatenes.com for the finest NES app out there out of the three or four that exist. I'm happy about that.
I'm happy for you.
Are you?
I am.
So, Ian,
so bad.
YouTube is over, according to a lot of people. The advertisers are pulling out. Google's running around with their hair on fire. You know, Google's like a collective person. It's like a giant.
I'd rather be getting my teeth pulled right now.
You can't say you're not interested in talking about the topic before we're talking about the topic. But, you know, there's a good update here. When we spoke about it originally, I always thought it was good that these issues are coming to light about advertisers being concerned about where their ads are being placed, because eventually this is going to happen.
Yes.
I'm surprised it took this long into ads being on YouTube, which is like 8 years at this point. So it's here. Google's responded in a positive way, giving more control to advertisers. So that's good. They updated their ad policies, and they also updated their sort of, I guess, minimum views per channel in order to place ads even to begin with, to sort of verify as well.
This is what I like about this. And people were all up in arms about this for absolutely no fucking...
It's censorship!
Well, I'm going to touch on the monetization thing, because it leads right into what I wanted to say and kind of what you were going to say. So you cannot receive ads or be monetized now until you have a total amount of 10,000 views on your channel.
Yes.
So lifetime views.
And that's for new channels starting, but I think you're grandfathered in.
You are grandfathered in, but yes, for starting for new channels. The people who complained about this, I don't think... I mean, you're not making any goddamn money if you have less than 10,000 views on your lifetime channel anyways.
10,000 views, if you want to be generous, is probably worth a maximum of $20. Probably closer to 10 to 15.
Congratulations, you got yourself two burritos and a six-pack of shit beer.
So you basically lost nothing. If that's why you think you're uploading videos to get to $10, that's you're hustling backwards. It's not worth your time.
Right. But I think the more important thing here is once you reach that 10,000, this is a very good way for YouTube to nip potential advertising problems in the bud, because then once you hit that 10,000, now YouTube basically gets to quick review your channel, see what your content is, and decide whether or not this is something that is going to be advertiser friendly.
Yes.
And I think that's a very smart move. If they need to, well, they absolutely do need to keep their advertisers in mind, and this is an easy way to do it because there's a gate now that these people have to get through.
There's a small gate, and I'd argue they could even increase it, and I wouldn't care. Most people, they put it 25,000 or 30,000.
If you put any effort into it, you can get 10,000 views.
Sure.
Or
even if you never get there again, you haven't lost anything of literally of value.
Right.
But what's also important about this is think about how many channels are out there that don't have 10,000 views that get ads, because now anyone get ads on.
Right.
In the past. So everyone else's CPM is lower because the ads are being distributed over so many more channels that honestly, you know, if you have a channel out there and you're getting 2 views per video, advertisers don't want to advertise on you. They'd rather go somewhere else. You know, it's just the way it is.
Correct.
So the ads that would have been on these small startup channels are now going to be filled to larger channels. And again, 10,000 isn't even that small. That's a drop in the bucket. It's just that you flesh out all these beginner channels that could be awful. It could be like fucking ISIS uploading videos. You don't know who's going to be uploading videos. It could be awful content.
Or just dead channels that someone started and never did anything with that are somehow still getting ads to them.
The whole point is that it makes the ad sharing, fresher for everyone. It keeps the ad ecosystem, I think, going a little bit more pure. And I think advertisers would feel confident that they know that, okay, you're not just letting ads put on any... Because any asshole can create an account on YouTube in 5 minutes. All you need is an email address. And so it's at least some protection. And I haven't really seen anyone say this is not reasonable. If anything, I saw people say, yeah, it should be higher. Put it, like I said, put it 30, 40, 50. I don't think people would complain that much. But the other big news is that, and again, this happened within like a week and a half. So Google, they should have been on this track. it sometimes just takes sort of like a kick in the ass to get this stuff going. So Google's parent company is Alphabet. They changed the name. So they implemented a new algorithm in order to weed out bad content. And it's already, it looks like they've flagged 5 times as many videos as too offensive for ads in recent weeks versus weeks before.
Right.
So this is important. It's a new system that lets outside firms verify ad quality standards on its video service while expanding its definitions of offensive content. So you want to speak to this?
Yeah. So let me pull this.
It's an artificial.
There's a whole list.
Yeah, it's an artificial intelligence tools that they're now going to be using for the entirety of YouTube with basically a learning form of AI that hopefully doesn't take over the world and nuke us, because a lot of YouTubers deserve to be nuked. So what's interesting is that this existed, like Alphabet/Google had this, but they never used it. They never implemented it on for YouTube videos before.
So are we talking about the sensitive content options that they can choose?
I'm talking about the AI they're now using, too.
Oh, okay.
In order to filter out some of this garbage content.
All right, the AI was not something that I'm particular... that was over my head. But looking at the solution, like they were saying, there was a three-pronged approach to it, and there are options that the advertisers can kind of select to more focus target where their ads are going. So
that's on the advertiser side. I was talking about what's on Google side.
Oh, okay.
To get rid of the bad content.
You go with Google side, and then I'll go sure. on advertiser
so,
side.
So like I said, it's a machine learning technology that they're just implementing now. You know, go out. You know, I can't imagine how many trillions of gigs of YouTube videos, but just start crawling through these videos and start flagging the bad ones en masse. And obviously, if you get flagged for something that shouldn't be monetized, you can then appeal. I had one video flagged where it said this is, when I talked about the anti-Semitic PewDiePie jokes, that got flagged saying this is not advertiser friendly. I appealed, and within a day it was saying, okay, this is fine. So they're gonna go through and start doing that, probably as stuff is uploaded based upon keywords or SEO, probably description and things of that nature. If it can actually gauge the actual content, then that's scary Skynet territory, where like if it actually can tell from the video content if it's offensive or not. I don't want to go there, and I don't think that's what this is at this point.
It might be the daytime extra maximum strength Mucinex, but that's
blowing your mind?
That's blowing my mind. On the advertiser side, there's a number of ways that they can direct this as well. There's sensitive content options and sensitive subjects that they can use to weed out display network ads and video ads from targeting certain things, such as crime, police, and emergency type videos, police blotters, news stories, death and tragedy, military and international conflicts, juvenile, gross, and bizarre content, like jokes, weird pictures, videos of stunts. I'm assuming that means pranks, profanity and rough language, and sexually suggestive content. Sensitive subjects like sensitive social issues, tragedy, and conflict, if they don't want to monetize off of that. Profanity and rough language, sexually suggestive content, and sensational and shocking.
So it's giving advertisers the tools they didn't have before to at least say, okay, I prefer we don't put our ads for macaroni and cheese in front of, you know, a video about Syrian chemical warfare.
Right.
You know, like that's something we don't want associated with our Velveeta shells and cheese.
Yeah, we don't want to, you know, put an ad involving a loving couple in front of, sexually suggestive content that might be, about sex crimes or something like that.
Sure.
So, it's allowing a lot more control on the end of the advertisers as well. And I think it's a pretty good start as long as it all works out.
This is only good because this gives advertisers confidence to come back and then confidence to spend more money. If they know their money is going more towards where they are directing it to go, they are more likely to pump in more dollars. In the long run, this is a huge win for Google, and that's how it's being analyzed on financial websites. Yes, they might have had the short-term loss of a few weeks of these advertisers pulling out, but in the long run, this is what you needed. This is how it should have evolved. And you can get on saying, well, you're going to be censoring out if you don't want, the political, I've seen stuff like, oh, no, the political talk shows aren't getting ads. I've heard that too from both. I've seen a conservative YouTuber say, I'm not getting ads displayed. I've seen a liberal one. Then other people say, I see the ads, they're back. It could have been temporary. The bottom line is this. If advertisers don't want to spend with you, they don't want to spend with you.
Yeah.
And you can't force them to. That's just capitalism. But it is, though.
Capitalism.
If people don't want to put ads in front of the CU podcast because they hate us having beards and looking this devilishly handsome, then that's their prerogative. And then, you know, you can be supported elsewhere. Patreon is becoming greater and greater. But I think this is a natural progression. Will you see certain genres die out? Thank God, probably yes.
Yes.
I can't see how, like, if I'm selling cars, I'm selling the freaking new Honda Accord, I want that ad in front of a fucking prank invasion video, for example. So if some genres die out that are mindless, that got away with getting money from advertisers, where the audience wasn't going to... People watching prank invasion aren't buying fucking Lexuses, you know? So, like, it's just a waste of the advertiser's dollar. So I'm all for this. I don't really see a negative at this point, unless you try to say that, well, they're going to not show ads in front of, you know, people that with this political slant or that political slant. Let's get there first, and we can address that if that happens. But in terms of websites and blogs that have political slants, they get advertisers. So you'll still have advertisers come over to that, probably. It may not be the same advertiser, but it might happen. But we're not there yet.
I mean, Christ, look at fucking cable news networks with political slants.
Sure.
CNN gets advertisers. Fox News gets advertisers. I mean, what? It should be no different for YouTube with political slants.
What we can get into if we transition to another topic is that business works upon, will I make money or not? Is this a smart decision where I'm going to make money? Advertisers will continue to go to YouTube because that's where the young people are. They grow up. That's their new form of entertainment. That's the new quote unquote TV. They're not gonna stay away from it. You could have said this was leverage for them to get a better deal, to say, well, your ads aren't worth as much as quote unquote a legacy or the mainstream or old school media. You know, but I really think this is they were concerned. And I don't see that they should not have been. Because if I'm spending $200,000 at a clip on advertising and it shows up on shit content that I don't want, that's a huge problem.
Yeah. Sure.
It's not like these companies are just have money to burn all the time and then it doesn't affect their bottom line. It does.
Yeah.
Which leads us to another topic, Ian.
Yes, it does. One that I believe you're leading off on.
So, a video came out from H3H3, Ethan Klein. We've covered Ethan before. In mostly positive light.
Yes.
He did the good work to help uncover the fucking asshole Counter-Strike fucking CSGO skin fucking underground mafia asshole scam fucks.
We both charred the asses of the pranksters as well.
The pranksters, and then I think there was also the FUPA thing, where the legal defense fund.
Yeah.
He helped get going, and there could have been one other one. That's come up where Ethan has done a good job highlighting some of these issues. Maybe the freaking people that try to copyright the genre of video, the React videos,
I think
he might have done something for that too. So he's been around. So, but this was a misfire, we'll just say, from H3H3. So
definitely a case of shooting first and asking questions later backfiring.
So what happened was, there was a report from, you know, the Wall Street Journal. And the Wall Street Journal has been in the news because of the PewDiePie situation.
Right.
And they shed a light on all the litany of jokes and sort of questionable content that was, at the time, kid-friendly advertising, believe it or not. And so people were already on this Wall Street Journal being bad guys sort of syndrome before all this happened. But then Wall Street Journal started to go around and started looking at questionable videos and seeing if advertisers, ads were running on them. And they found one with a very negative title, I'll just say.
I feel like we're on a carousel here.
A carousel of topics?
Yeah.
So they found a video that shouldn't have had a Coca-Cola ad being placed on it. It was a Coke ad. So from that, the timing's a little bit skewed about what happened where, but soon that was like right before these advertisers started pulling out en masse, saying we don't trust what's going on with YouTube now. So people blamed the Wall Street Journal for sort of starting this or helping to fan the flames of these advertisers being concerned because, you know, they, you know, they, hey, they ran a story. Coke finds out. Coke's probably like, what the hell's going on? So what Ethan H3H3 then looked into was the actual video itself, and he contacted the person who ran it. He said, hey, are you running ads on, are ads running on this video? Are you making money off this video? And the person running the YouTube channel looked at his analytics, sent a screenshot, and said, oh, no, I haven't made, you know, money on this video since last year. I've made nothing. So from that bit of information, H3H3 then comes out and said the Wall Street Journal fabricated the entire story.
No, fabricated the screenshot.
Oh, sure. Fabricating the screenshot, created a screenshot. Well, therefore, you'd be fabricating a story.
Well, but, sure.
But at first, the internet went nuts. Twitter went nuts. YouTubers, people I like Review Tech USA, I saw tweets from people like Peanut Butter Gamer saying, you have a lot to answer for, Wall Street Journal, and the guy who wrote the article. You have a lot to answer for. This is fucking
who
bullshit.
Who also co-wrote the PewDiePie article.
This is fucking bullshit. I hope Google sues you. This is ridiculous. Fucking mob. Because now they see this war. They see a war between the quote-unquote mainstream media and the YouTubers, and they're butting heads for that same dollar. And I'll tell you in a second why that's a dumb argument. But now, that's what happened.
What's interesting is that Ethan uploaded an apology hours later, but the shot was already fired and
the blood was in the water, for
especially because it being the Wall Street Journal and a YouTube story. Now, YouTube versus Wall Street Journal at this point was too hot.
Sure. So why did he upload that the apology? I'm asking you, Ian. I'll tell you why, Ian. He uploaded it. Are you out of it? Because it turns out on that video, the advertising was running still.
Oh, because the advertising was running still because it had been claimed by the
person that
the rapper Chief Keef, the network that he's under, which actually I believe is the network that Ethan is under. So the money was being siphoned to the network and the artist.
So what happens when a copyright claim comes in, the video stays up, money will still be made, ads will still run, but just not to the person who uploaded the video.
Right.
So I have I think one of my early Flea Market Madness videos, for example, I have a Super Mario Brothers 2 song in the back end of it. Nintendo claimed that video years ago. Evil Nintendo. So ads will still run. I don't get the money. When I go into analytics, I don't see any money being made, but someone's making money. It's the big Nintendo dog making the money.
Yeah.
On the back of small YouTuber Pat.
So other people can still be making money even though the uploader is not. And that's, I suppose, in the heat of a moment, that is something that is forgotten.
So the accusation that they created screenshots is dangerous.
It could be really devastating to a journalist's career.
Not just from the people, you know, going after the guy personally. I'm sure he probably got some death threats on Twitter.
He definitely did.
But it's dangerous because you're accusing this heralded news site of creating a story where they'd have nothing to gain if they made it up. They'd have nothing to gain, but everything to lose. Why would the Wall Street Journal make that shit up? What would be the possible benefit to make the advertisers feel unsteady or not sure about YouTube? Even if that happened, that money wasn't going to get siphoned back to the Wall Street Journal or the quote-unquote mainstream media, because there are entirely different audiences watching YouTube videos and reading sites like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal. Different demographics, different makeup probably economically by large, and especially by age.
Right.
So it's not a zero-sum game when it comes to advertising. And I think that's what these YouTubers are missing out on. When they try to create in their head this sort of war, which is sexy as fuck to say, we're in a war.
Yeah.
Let's grab my cosplay plastic sword and Viking helmet. I don't know.
What the fuck?
I don't know. The point is this, though. It's really a romantic notion to beat the drums of war, to say it's them against us, when there's really no war. First of all, there's no battlefield to actually wage it on. And it's not like the Wall Street Journal is going to put out a snarky 5-minute response saying, fuck you guys. You know, like, it's not, it's totally, it's a totally different medium.
If you leave out the PewDiePie thing, all this is it, it's, this is not an attack on YouTube. This is a Wall Street Journal article about the evolution of advertising and how...
It's a totally legit story.
Yeah, about how Google needs to... Well, like we just talked about, how Google needs to take action about how ads are handled and how they're going to change it. It's only because YouTube was still so hot over the PewDiePie thing that tempers flared and, like I said, shots were fired before, I think... total investigation was done. I read something somewhere, and I do kind of agree with this, that Ethan Klein did do some research here that could lead to some conclusions, but it wasn't thorough. And I think what people tend to do in these instances is forget that perhaps the other people have done their research as
well. Yeah, do you honestly think Coca-Cola would pull advertising based upon a Wall Street Journal story? You know what I mean? Like, you don't think they would have done their due diligence themselves talking to Google and being like, is this ad actually running on here or what's going on? When these tons of companies, dozens and dozens of companies pull their ads, I'm not sure if all of them are back yet, you don't think they looked into it themselves? You don't think they have a Google rep to talk to really talk about, okay, what's going on here? They're not looking for YouTubers to do exposés on it.
Well, and whatever you think on the PewDiePie thing, this reporter, and now his name is slipping my mind, but after the fallout from that, you would also think that perhaps he is also doing more due diligence on the reporting of something like
Jack
this.
Jack Nikas is the reporter.
Nikas, okay. Yeah, I was going to say Nicole.
I saw Nikas. Him get hate. The problem when this stuff happens, and with retractions in general, the first story always gets like 10 times the amount of views and eyes versus the retraction.
Sure.
This accusation was fake news. It was absolutely fake news. It was dead sure that, oh, this is what's going on. Mm-hmm. You know, like, Wall Street Journal, I'm not saying they should, they could send lawyers after someone for saying that you made up a story. You made up screenshots. I hope they don't do that, but that's how serious that video was and how much heat they got for someone saying things that weren't true. This is their response to all the hullabaloo. The Wall Street Journal stands by its March 24th report that major brand advertisers were running alongside objectionable videos on YouTube. Any claim that the related screenshots or any other reporting was in any way fabricated or doctored is outrageous and false. The screenshots related to the article, which represent only some of those found, were captured on March 23rd and March 24th. And it goes on from there. The journal is proud of its reporting and the high standards it brings to its journalism. We go to considerable lengths to ensure its accuracy and fairness, and that is why we are among the most trusted source of news in the world. Again, this is a conspiracy theory that's totally, at this point, false. In order for these conspiracies to be true, especially in this case, you'd have to have not just the author make it up, the editor would have to be on it to approve it as well, and then who knows who else at the Wall Street Journal. Again, for what possible gain to make up, you know, quote-unquote fake news that actually was true?
Yeah.
So, as my pal, Norm the Gaming Historian, said on Twitter eloquently, when you hear hoof steps, assume it's a horse before a zebra.
Yes. That is a very good quote.
So, from here, I think, it's always sexy to say there's a war going on. YouTube is dead. Fucking relax. Be an adult. And I'll just say this as to close it, since you look like you're in pain from listening to me.
It's not from listening to you.
There's a danger to me personally when and it's not a bitterness or jealousy. People say it is, but I don't have the voice of other YouTubers that get these headlines for now the wrong reasons. when advertisers and people in the mainstream now see the YouTubers coming, becoming more and more in the mainstream for really bad reasons, it's bad for everyone. So when you're going to accuse a major news organization, you better have your ducks in a fucking row before you do that. Because you only represent yourself, but people are going to think you represent all of us, and you don't.
Yeah.
You don't represent Ian, me, or other people I know when you do shit that turns that goes south in a jiffy.
In a jiffy.
In a jiffy? Are we sponsored by Jiffy?
No, Jiffy's crap peanut butter. There's so much sugar in that shit.
I only do all natural peanut butter at this point. Was it Ann Scudders? Annie Scudders? Is that the one? What's her name?
I don't know. Scudders is a really weird last name.
Okay, moving on.
Moving on.
Ian, you like food, don't you?
Yes, I do.
You know there's a service where you can get fresh ingredients to prepare your own meals every week. It's called Blue Apron.
Indeed.
And we got a chance to try it out. And you liked it, didn't you?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun with it.
What did you get from them?
So I made, I received Parmesan crusted chicken.
Oh, nice.
And I also received pork with Korean rice cakes, which I was actually very excited to make. And that's the one that I made first.
And I got Fontina stuffed pork chops and chicken under a brick. Now, you think that, hey, I'm not a chef. I can't make this stuff. Well, the cool thing about Blue Apron is that they send you all the prepackaged ingredients to the specifications. No, you don't have to measure anything yourself. You know what I mean? You don't have to worry about any of that. They give you the meats. They give you the ingredients. They give you the instructions on cool cards like this. And it's pretty foolproof to make, like, good meals. It's not just, like, scratch meals where you might screw something up. No, if you follow the, you know, you're going to get a restaurant-quality meal.
Yeah. Most of the meals are about... I would say two pans. So if you're good at multitasking, they're actually pretty quick to make. Everything, there's just a little bit of prep involved with like your aromatics, like ginger, garlic, stuff like that. And then you're ready to go. It's interesting because you get to try these different types of meals. You get to try something Korean, say, and you get these ingredients that instead of having to go out and buy these large bottles of, say, these sauces and things, they give you just enough. So there isn't any waste. Instead of spending $6 and going out to a market to buy the sauce that you may never use again, you get just enough for that meal so that you can try it and get the whole shebang.
Yeah.
And because everything is already measured out in terms of these sauces, the meals come together very quickly. And the other thing I very much liked about Blue Apron is when they say it's a four... See, I got the two meals that serve four people each. I believe you got the... What did you pick?
I got three meals that serve two people.
Gotcha. But I found that those serving sizes were actually very accurate.
They're pretty on target. I mean, like for example, I had the pork chop. So it was one pork chop stuffed with Fontina cheese, basically a potato that you roasted in the pan with some stuff in there to do that, and some sweet peppers with a tomato paste and other stuff. I'm not doing it justice. And it was just enough for me. I was surprised. Like, you know, this isn't going to fill me. It actually filled me up.
Yeah,
I was shocked by that.
With the pork and rice cakes, Vani and I got two good-sized dinners and enough leftovers for each of us to take for lunch, actually, today.
So this is less than $10 per meal. Seasonal recipes that are available on their website. The ingredients are always fresh, delivered right to your door. Like I said, new recipes every week. You can customize your recipes based upon your preferences as well. There's delivery options so you can get it delivered to fit your needs. And there's no weekly commitment. You only get deliveries when you want them. And each meal, like we said, is step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe cards in my hand, pre-portioned ingredients, can be prepared in 40 minutes or less, and there's a guarantee of freshness as well. So they're a proud sponsor now of the CU Podcast, if you haven't told. So you can check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping. Go to blueapron.com/unnecessary. That's blueapron.com/unnecessary. We'll probably get that changed to something easier, but for now, it's UNNECESSARY. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Unnecessary always gives me trouble.
Ian, did you see that Nintendo Direct?
Yeah, I did see that Nintendo Direct. What a weird Nintendo Direct that was.
That was almost like when you're in first grade... figure out a way to repeat the sentence and say the same thing in a different way. You know?
Yeah, I'm good at that sometimes. So, what I thought was cool about it was they very much showed that the 3DS is not dead yet. And I was happy about that because I really I love the 3DS. Yeah!
That's IGN's...
Yeah, Pat, never muting your fucking computer before we start.
Blame IGN's auto ads with fucking five-hour energy. All right, go.
Yeah, okay, I'll blame that. It was neat to see that. It was neat to see that they're going to be doing another Kirby game. It was neat to see that they're doing, a turn-based Monster Hunter RPG, which really is interesting to me because they've all been action-based, almost...
they've been more twitchy, right?
They're like Phantasy Star Online times 10 dungeon crawler crafting grinds. They're really okay. Fun. We're getting some more 3DS stuff. That's cool.
They're getting, Project... that's a Switch one.
No, this is all Switch stuff in the article I linked to. So,
thanks, Ian, for fucking submarining me. Anyway, go on.
I didn't. I even put it in the topic. So, that's cool. That was a cool thing. Another cool thing was we finally have release dates for ARMS and Splatoon 2, which are two very cool-looking games for the Switch that people are definitely looking forward to, I believe. ARMS is June 11th, and Splatoon 2 is July 21st, which is actually earlier than I thought might be.
ARMS looks more interesting the more they show it. It's a little bit more deeper, I think, than people originally gave it. I think originally people were like, well, this is sort of like Wii Boxing, but for the Switch. So now you're looking at different types of attacks, different upgrades, different types of weaponry. It looks like there's some nuance to this.
I also think people calm the fuck down about it when they realize that it's not going to force motion controls.
That too.
So, you know, you don't have to do this fucking punching shit. That's when I suddenly became very interested in it. So that was cool. But then they went on to announce a whole bunch of other shit that, at least in my opinion, took a bit of wind out of my sails. Now, they've got to announce this stuff at some point, I guess.
Are you talking 3DS or Switch?
Switch.
You're going to go back to the Switch, okay.
We're going back to the Switch. I think that's far more important.
Okay.
Disgaea 5 Complete. Okay, cool. We've had Disgaea 5. That's been out. Payday 2. That game's about 4 years old.
You know, when I saw that, I couldn't remember when that came out. I remember seeing a trailer for that. Was it 4 years ago?
At least, I think. 3-4 years ago. Sonic Forces. Okay, that's cool. Probably going to be multi-plat.
It's a new game.
That's a new game. That's a sequel that's the sequel basically to Sonic Generations.
Minecraft?
Yay.
It's got to be on your system, though.
Yeah,
it has a Nintendo why pack is it, built
I
in.
Mean, who doesn't? I mean, great, exciting. So exciting.
If you have a kid, they want to play Minecraft.
Sure.
That's not a system. How about
Fate Extella? Okay, that's like a Dynasty Warriors type game. It came for the PS4 and Vita, so it's a port. Puyo Puyo Tetris is probably going to be a lot of fun on the Switch. Looking forward to it. It is being brought over for the PS4 and the Switch, so that's cool. Monopoly. Really? You feel like you need to show off Monopoly for the Switch? You're going to hype up Monopoly, one of the world's worst fucking board games?
I hope you bite through your tongue completely. I've been playing Monopoly games behind consoles. Is that too harsh? Sorry. I've played the NES one. I play it on my fucking IBM XT. I love Monopoly video games.
You're exciting.
Okay.
Remember that tweet I made earlier about you having bad taste? Double time.
Taste this finger, asshole.
Double
taste
time.
It. When they showed that Monopoly, it actually looked a little more interesting than I thought. I was neutral. I was like, I like the animations. I like it. You can take it and put it on your table because you have the tabletop mode and you can have four controllers. If that's like a $30 game, why not? I'm not saying you're going to spend $60 on that.
Okay.
Well, do people buy board games, like old school board games anymore like that? Do they still play Clue?
I play board games a lot.
Okay. I'm not talking about tabletop games where now there's like 1,000 pieces and 4,800 rules. I'm talking about the traditional ones. All right, you got it going on?
You want me to be honest about something? Vani felt like I deserved something very nice after 6 months of this bullshit. And I woke up sick in bed at about 2 in the afternoon and rolled over and found a Switch on my bed.
Oh.
And one of the first games I got for it was Othello.
Yeah, okay, so you can fuck off then. Make fun of my Monopoly. How about you care about more Neo Geo games on the console coming?
Yes. So I
Namco
love...
Museum? Yeah. Come on!
Yeah, but okay, Cinemora EX. I beat Cinemora EX on the 360. I mean, it's a good game, but
Sonic
it's
Mania.
Another fucking port.
That was a Kickstarter, wasn't it?
Yeah, I have it pre-ordered for the PS4. Rayman Legends Definitive Edition. Great, a definitive edition of a game we've all been able to play before.
Let me just say this. They had Rolling Thunder show on the Nintendo Direct, and I was like, I'm getting hard.
This Namco Museum could be great if they just stop fucking around and put...
hold on. It does only have like 9 games. Is that right?
No, that's what's announced so far. If they can just...
It better have what's on the fucking PS2 like anniversary one. There's like 35 games or whatever.
There's not even that many on the anniversary one. They need to stop fucking around and just compile all of the various Namco museums together. This is not exciting.
You're not excited for Ultra Street Fighter 2? Insane Edition with first-person perspective Hadoukens. I don't know how that's going to work into the game. It just looked interesting.
Sort of.
But again, what are the prices of these? So if like Ultra Street Fighter 2 is like a $30 game...
It's not. It's $50.
Then I'm not... Again, you can't sell me the same game again that I bought an Xbox 360 like 5 years ago for like
$15. I think it's just the same graphics. I don't think it's got the same balance tweaks. I hope not.
They upgraded the graphics, and you can go back to the retro graphics.
And too. It adds Evil Ryu and Evil Ken.
I don't care
about that. So I understand that they're holding out for heavy hitters at E3.
Well, you got Mario Kart 8 Deluxe. That's gonna do gangbusters.
Yes. So I'm okay with. So this is the thing. I'm okay with I don't know how to explain this. I'm okay with them announcing the release dates of those big games that we were all already looking forward to, right?
Okay.
But I feel like that this list of kind of lukewarm announcements, while some of these could be pretty cool, I feel like if depending on what type of gamer you are, you look at this and you see ports or multiplats, you're not seeing any exclusives. I don't see that getting a lot of people who are sitting on the fence getting super excited about it.
But Ian, right now there's not people sitting on the fence. I don't think that people understand that we are still in the springtime. And that's not common for a release, especially a Nintendo console. And it's still sold out everywhere.
I feel like it would have been better to withhold at least some of these less exciting things like Monopoly. And
you're just saying from a marketing standpoint, don't show this as your main title.
Don't drop all of this at once. Keep some things like Monopoly and the Namco Museum out of this presentation.
Okay.
And then... put it...
Don't even bring it up. You're saying just
slide them out at E3. Slide them out at E3 with everything else good that you've got so that people don't think that this is all that's coming down the pipeline.
This is all that's coming down the pipeline for next couple months. This is in right now.
No, I know, but it's like, you know, everyone who...
Well, who are you?
Everyone who wanted a Switch was okay with... was basically okay with what was leading up to the rest of the year.
But... this doesn't change what was announced before. It's not like they have canceled or pushed back stuff that was announced before it came out when they had their list of like 80 games or titles. You don't like the optics of it. You don't always like how.
No, I'm always looking at the psychological viewpoint of how this might appear to people.
I would say this: the dirty casuals won't start buying this until at least the summer, if not the fall. And then because summer you have kids on vacation, you buy something for them. The fall, obviously, you know, that's when stuff usually comes out, new systems. And then for Christmas, everyone's going to buy it no matter what.
So right now, it's just to keep the early adopters satisfied.
Right.
And they are, because there's one fucking huge game on the system that if you bought that game, you're good for the next 5 months.
Bomberman's good.
And Bomberman for you, Ian.
Fast RMX is good.
But Zelda. Zelda is the game that they held back from the Wii U for obvious reasons, because they had to make the Switch a success. And it's a success. They're doubling the production amount, and they'll probably sell a good chunk of that doubling this year. You know, so I think they'll be fine, because there's a lot of people that remember Mario Kart 8. I love Mario Kart 8.
Oh, yeah.
On the Wii U.
It's a fucking fantastic
game. You know what the problem is? Not a lot of people had the Wii U. So there's going to be people that are going to discover this game for the first time. This is like a fucking promo for them. But people will be discovering this game for the first time on the Switch. Because on the Wii, the biggest selling title, almost 40 million, was Mario Kart Wii. 40 million, and I think on the Wii U, it went down to like 9 or 10. Or a little bit less. That's an awful drop-off.
You make a good point that I was too dumb to see there. And you're right. This is going to be the first time a lot of people play Mario Kart 8.
And plus, they're going to add in, I think, the DLC.
It's the original game, all the original DLC, and more characters.
And a proper battle mode, I think, it looks
like. A proper battle mode.
With real battle mode tracks.
And it was originally rumored to have additional tracks too, but actually that might just be they said that there was going to be more DLC.
Either way,
anyways,
that'll carry it, I think, to the summer. Splatoon 2, that's more of a game that doesn't appeal to everyone, but it appeals to a swath of people, but not like Mario Kart does. And then once you get to the fall, we'll see what's there, and then you have the home run that hopefully it has to come out before Christmas. Mario Odyssey, it has to. I mean, I don't care if they
they're already crunching on it. They're calling it Mario Time.
Mario time?
That's what they're referring to crunch time as on Mario. Instead of calling it crunch time, they're calling it Mario.
So they realize that this has to come out to sell the system.
When they're working late nights and nonstop shifts right now on Mario, they're calling it Mario time.
So we'll see. But yes, going back to the 3DS real quick, so I think we should speak to this more. This is of course goodwill to the third-party developers that have kept 3DS afloat for the past 5 years. The reason it's a success is because of the third-party
support. It is a sex. I rub my 3DS on my dong all the time.
But even though the 3DSs are not selling as well, because everyone has one that wants one, they've sold a ton, and Nintendo has to respect that, obviously, and these developers think that, oh, we're going to still make money, we're going to make games for it. So I think that 3DS development is going to go well into next year, I think. And then it'll probably die off.
Yeah, there's not a lot of like digital titles, and I think I read somewhere that there's like nothing else on the virtual console on the horizon, but I guarantee you this, and this is kind of how it always seems to go with consoles, especially if you're an RPG fan, you're lucky, because you always see some RPGs come out at the tail end of a system's lifespan. And there's going to be some good ones.
Well, plus, remember, the 3DS for a smaller developer is going to be still simple to develop for versus going up to the
and
Switch.
And cheaper, exactly.
And cheaper. So it's less risk to them, less resources. They can probably sell it at a lower price. Nintendo still gets a cut of that, you know, if it's a digital download or whatever. So, I mean, there's no reason not to stop selling games for a successful system.
And I think one last important point to make is it gives Nintendo a little bit more breathing room on deciding what the hell their actual plan is going forward. Are they actually going to use the Switch as a replacement for both home and portable, or what?
I think it'll probably depend upon these third-party developers.
Almost everyone I know who has a Switch rarely docks it. I think
it's a little dangerous to have that, be toting that around like you would a 3DS, though, because it's a lot bigger. It can be
no, I realize it, and I obviously know that people do dock it, but I know a lot of people play it on the comfort of their couch in portable mode.
What if they shrink that fucker down in a couple of years? You know, the technology always shrinks. It's cheaper. I'm just saying.
And I believe on April 19th, you'll be able to buy separate docks, which leads me to believe that they might start selling it separately.
Well, you could before, but now they're coming back into stock. The docks were very, I think, limited before, which shows me that the reason they're limited, they're having trouble, obviously, keeping up the pace of producing these things. And, of course, you'd want the main system to sell first. But, yes, you want to have – some households are going to buy an extra dock, but they're like $90. You know, so that's going to deter a lot. But yeah, why not? If you have like, you know, upstairs, downstairs, you don't want to unplug the dock, you know, why not?
So I'm excited about those neon Joy-Cons to go with the arms, though. That's not a gimmick. Oof.
The banana yellow.
Sure.
God, I'm dying. Let's move on.
Ian, you used to emulate, right?
Yeah. Man, discovering emulation was mind-blowing back in the day. And what was the first one? FNES? INES?
Those the first? Was INES the first? I don't remember FNES.
Or INES. Maybe that's what it was called. But it didn't have sound, and you had to pay to unlock it. But then, along April 3rd, 1997, Nesticle is released. And the doors were blown wide open.
Created by Sardu of Bloodlust Software.
And, man, Nesticle took up so much of my time. It's the 20th anniversary of it. And while it's no longer updated and hasn't been updated in forever, the importance of Nesticle cannot be overstated. Not only was it the first freeware NES emulator, it was the first one to allow you to record a run. It was the first one to allow you to access sprite files and create ROM hacks with new graphics and things like that.
It simple had, to use GUI.
Yeah, an easy to use graphical user interface. Ran in both DOS and Windows 95.
Easy controller support.
Yep, controller support.
It played almost the entire library.
Not flawlessly, but yeah.
It ran them.
It ran them. You know, there's very few things that you would run into problems
with. Does it play Castlevania 3?
But it was awesome. All bow down to the fecal lord.
You know, for years, I didn't realize that the icon was a testicle.
You didn't?
With a pointer. I had no idea. I thought it was just a bloody hand. I had no idea.
Oh, yeah. No, it's testicle.
If you don't know, when you're using Nesticle, it's NES plus testicle. The little mouse pointer is a bloody testicle. Try to get a bigger picture. Is that a testicle? Is that a penis? Or is that a hand with a finger? I can't tell. I cannot fucking tell.
Oh, the icon was a testicle. I don't know about the hand. The pointer.
I'm looking at it right now, and I still can't tell.
Well,
it could be both.
I thought that was a bloody hand.
Okay, I thought it was a...
Yeah, no, I thought that was a bloody
I thought
hand.
It was a nut sack.
Who knows?
Well, what's amazing, though, is that, like Ian said, they I think the last version was, like, 98 when this came out. So within, like, a year of it being released, this was, like, the basis for other emulators to follow. Like, it sort of... This was, I guess, like the Wolfenstein 3D of NES emulators. Like, you had to start from here.
I'd give it the Doom. I'd call it the Doom.
Oh, really? You just go, you Doom it up. Okay.
Yeah. Because there were emulators prior to this, but this was the Doom. I believe Sardu went on to do Genesis, which was the first Genesis emulator I used. But I don't think that was supported for very long. And there were slowdown issues and problems with Genesis, from what I remember. But, man, I remember sitting around with my first girlfriend in high school, and we would just download ROMs and ROMs and ROMs and play them, and then we'd go to the flea markets on Saturdays and or Sundays, and then just go buy the games that we liked the most when they were super cheap, and then play them on the TV. And that's kind of where my opinion has always come from, that emulation's not a bad thing. I mean, to me and to a lot of other people, emulation was a great way to find those games you wanted to physically own back in the day.
Sure. Like I said, this is what helped me get back into Nintendo games.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Because if you're in the late 90s and you're just hanging out, you're in your dorm room or whatever, you're at high school, you're home, like, you know, I remember playing Nintendo games 10 years ago. Let's just search it. Oh, there's TSR's NES Archive. How do I play these? How do I play and go into Alta Vista at the time? Or web crawler was
Lycos.
Still there. Lycos.
Hotbot.
I liked Lycos and Alta Vista.
Web crawler.
That was like, or all the web's still around. But Jeeves isn't. But you would just put in, like, play NES games online, and then you'd be like, ooh, what's this? What's a ROM and an emulator? And then you find something like Nesticle. And it was simple to, like, download and install. ROMs were plentiful even back then. You couldn't find all of them easily, but you could find all the popular ones easily. And sort of, you know, this is before torrents, but you can find websites, like, probably I think even sites like Cool ROM probably exist back then,
cool
didn't
ROM,
they?
Yeah.
Cool ROM. Like you said, forever. You had save states. You can pause the game, resume it. Save states blew our minds when we were teenagers.
Oh, yeah.
Holy shit! I mean, I can finally get through the fucking top secret episode mazes without falling through the floor for the 80th fucking time in Brazil. You know, like you said, the gameplay movies. Where do you think a lot of the early, like, you know, when you look at like all those, the first 3-4 years of YouTube gameplay footage, NES games, those are almost all from emulators.
Yeah.
I guarantee you, like, if they're not using Nesticle, like, that forged the way for other ones to have saving gameplay either live or playing it back. A lot of them, you can save your own movies and basically play it back and then record. You can actually go back and watch it. This is important shit. But it's a shame that it wasn't continued on, because if it continued on, it could have been still around today, like, and up to date. But even back then, it ran on slow computers. It wasn't, like, you know, 2 frames a second. It was pretty smooth.
It runs basically perfectly on a 486. I think it even runs pretty solidly on a 386.
And the reason he stopped, it looked like, according to Wikipedia, a code cracker named Donald Moore, also known as Mind Rape, he stole the code. And then Sardu said, fuck this, I'm out. Which is a shame. You know, you hate that. You should have said, just fuck you to this guy and continue on. Please come back. Come back, Sardu. I want Nesticle 2.5 or whatever it's on. Anyway, so any other closing thoughts on Nesticle's 20-year anniversary? I think this is going to be the biggest sort of emulator like this, besides MAME, that we're going to remember 100 years from now as sort of like paving the way.
Yeah, no, I agree.
Like these two.
I agree.
Like TurboGrafx is only one major one, the Magic Engine, you know, and that came out so far long ago, and it's still like the only one, you know, that people really talk about.
Yeah, I think Magic Engine actually came out just a little bit after.
And that was paid, but it worked.
Yeah.
So that guy didn't have to update it. Like, that's one of those weird ones where, like, yeah, it works for every game. Fuck you.
That's
like,
what it says on the tin. Yeah, Magic Engine was...
Runs the CD games. It plays the ROMs of the other ones, you know?
Magic Engine was worth paying for. Although, you still have to burn the CDs to play them, I believe.
Oh, I'm sure that was cracked after that, but sure. And then the early Neo Geo ones, I remember being really good alongside MAME. The Genesis and Super Nintendo ones always took a while to catch up in terms of, you know, progression, but for obvious reasons, they're a little more complicated than just running, you know, Pac-Man and Mappy.
All right.
Loot Crate, Ian. Loot Crate.
Loot Crate.
You like Loot Crate, Ian. You like the crate of loot.
We all like Loot Crate.
I wear the shirts from time to time. There's always an exclusive toy or knickknack. The t-shirts are always exclusive, which
yes.
is nice.
The t-shirts are always cool, and I always enjoy the buttons and the knickknacks, I think, the most. Keychains, those little things. When they do the luggage tags, I always like those. Those are interesting. Lots of fun stuff inside a Loot Crate.
So you go to lootcrate.com/Pat and enter code Pat to save 10% on any new Loot Crate sign up. Ian, you want to know what the April theme is?
Yes.
It's investigate.
Uh-oh.
For April, join us as we salute some of our favorite mystery solvers with items from Stranger Things, Batman, The X-Files, and Marvel's Jessica Jones. One lucky subscriber will also win a mega crate, including signed copies of Jessica Jones, Alias, Volumes 1 through 4.
God damn, I want that.
You have until April 19th at 9 p.m. Pacific to subscribe and receive the April themes. Investigate. After that cutoff happens, that's it. It's over. You got to wait for May. Go to lootcrate.com/Pat, enter code PAT to save 10% again. And give the geek in your life a crate of loot, or yourself. Treat yourself, Ian. Do you treat yourself? You need to treat yourself with what's going on lately, I think. Breaking news, Ian.
Yeah.
I was alerted to this right before we started recording the podcast. Our favorite reality show, Storage Wars, which we've discussed before with a Nintendo game and video game finds, there was another storage locker of video games that just sold to my pal, Renee.
Oh, your favorite one-stop shop at the swap meet.
Yeah. He used to come to the swap meet. He's talking about his family. He was very nice in the beginning. He turned bitter and kind of sour after a while. He'll probably tweet at me after this segment, probably. But you know what? I'll fire back if he does. But that's okay. I'm going to try to be objective here.
He bought a storage unit for $1,500 that they claim had, like, what was it, $42,000 worth of video game merchandise in it. And they got to that extrapolation after going through some particulars at first that we saw. And the problem with these shows, there's two problems, is that they don't show you everything when they go through all these boxes.
Right.
So that's the first problem. So when they're giving these valuations, it's really tough to know if they're right or not for a lot of this stuff. But we did see some ones we can comment on. The other problem is that I don't know if they're in a rush or that. He had his assistant with him named Fluffy go through some stuff. And I'm not going to get on him in particular if he was wrong on some valuations. But you don't know. You don't. It's a rush through it, and you don't know. But
and problematically with shows like these, especially because they don't show you everything, you see things, a quick valuation is applied, you don't know what's being missed in a box, and this is how, and we've gotten on this before, this is how people end up thinking their trash is worth gold.
Sure. And the other times that video game showed up was with the NES 101 that they thought was worth whatever, $100,000, what it wasn't. And then when they went
the NES 001.
001, is that what it was? And then when Daryl went to that game store, and then the valuation was, we thought, at least 2 to 3 times more than what it should have been. And that was being generous at the time. So there was a bunch of boxes they found here. But the first thing they had was a tub of Genesis games. I want to say it was about 150 games.
There was a scat in there too for the NES.
The first thing they find is a scat for the NES with a bunch of Genesis games. I will not say that this stuff is made up, but I think it's strange that the only Nintendo game, the first thing you see on a pile of Genesis games, is a hard to find NES game. That said, they found it there. I'm going to assume everything that they found was there and is real.
Yeah.
But it was weird that that was on top of that. And maybe they transported it over to sort of sweeten that tub and say this is a better tub. But in that tub, they also found a Musha and a Sunset Riders, which is fine. I think the valuation is fair for the individual games. 200 for Musha. I think it's a 200 for Scat. Something like that.
And 50 for Sunset Riders. That's on the money.
The problem is giving a $3,000 valuation to the remaining tub. And when you look at that tub, you see some commons. You see stuff like Lion King real quick. Again, this is flashes of it.
Outrun.
Outrun. And these are all loose titles. So these are going to be much less than obviously complete in bucks. So a $3,000 valuation on about 150 games is $20 each. That's just not possible for that tub. Moving on. This is when Ian's interest really got piqued. There was a box, they said, about 300 Atari games, / some Intellivision games. I think there was an Emerson Arcadia game in there.
A lot of them were
7800.
5200 games, 5200. Which I like. I'm a 5200 fan. Valued at like $10 a piece. That's insane.
So he just throws out $3,000 for that box because he figures 300 times $10 each. For 5200... I think there were some 2600 games, Emerson Arcadia, and some miscellaneous games. As you and I know, Ian, selling Atari games loose is one of the hardest things to do to get rid of retro games.
Yeah.
It's not easy to do. And the higher-end titles that are uncommon might reach $10, $20, but the vast majority of Atari games are less than $5.
Even if you average it out and there was some supreme rarities in there, you're not hitting a $10 average per game.
Those 300 Atari games, / Intellivision, whatever else, are most likely not $3,000. You'd be lucky to get $800 probably.
Yeah, it's hilarious because that was actually the quote on the nose that I was about to say.
You're thinking about 800?
I was thinking about
800. You get about 250 each, $3, something in that range, and you'd be happy for that. There was a tub of... we didn't see if there's a TurboGrafx-16 system, but we saw about a stack of 10 HuCard TurboGrafx-16 games. About 10? I eyeballed 9 or 10? We'll just say 10. Where it was valued at $500. The one that was visible, though, was World Class Baseball, which is arguably the least valuable TurboGrafx game after Keith Courage and Alpha Zones.
I can't say what was underneath it.
No.
But the fact that they were loose, unless those were all extreme heavy hitters, I
you don't know.
Yeah.
But most likely...
I mean,
let's put it this way. If there was a highlight in there that was worth money and he pulled out a Musha,
you think that that person would be like, okay, here's Magical Chase, or, you know, here's even, I don't know, Parasol Stars, or, you know what I mean, or something like that.
It would have had to have been all stuff like Parasol Stars or Shooters.
Here's Time Cruise, or some uncommon ones. All right, the next one is really strange just because it was a flash of them fumbling with about 5 or 4 Game & Watches and then saying...
$800 for the box.
But
that could actually be true because Game & Watches can be worth a lot. The problem with that goes back to what we said about them flashing over stuff. You have no idea what else is in the box.
You don't have no idea.
I also didn't get to see what Game & Watches they were. Game & Watches can go for a lot, so that could actually be... accurate.
Could be true. If you have 10 to 20 gaming watches that are in decent shape.
However, $300 for a box containing an NES and some VHS tapes.
Okay, we made sure that this wasn't like the audio lined up with another visual. Renee leans over a box, has an NES in his hand, flips it, and then there's just VHS tapes underneath. Now, if you want to say there was a layer of box NES games somewhere there, okay, I can see that. But $300 for an NES by itself and VHS tapes that you will be... paying people to take from you, I don't see that happening. The next one I thought was the most insane one, just because it was $2,000 for a box of, it looked like 2600, 7800. There was, I think, there could have been an Emerson Arcadia there. It looked like the box I see at the flea market every other month, where there's a dusty old 2600, and then you have just 80 Atari games thrown next to it, and then the guy wants $40 for all of it, and you take it from him. And they said that was $2,000. If you know anything about Atari 700 and 2600 games, you need almost 2,000 games to get to that valuation of $2,000.
It looks like a box I've tripped over numerous times in the back of Luna.
You know, you have your classics like Enduro Racer, and you know, you might get your uncommon one, like your Spectra video or something in there that's worth like $5 or $10. But unless they're telling us individually, this one's worth $50. This is $100. This is $200 for Atari 2600 games, which there aren't that many, especially loose. That's not a $2,000 box. It ain't. The next one, they said $1,500 easy. Again, you don't see. I saw like 3 Tempest 2000 Jaguar boxes sitting there. Who the fuck knows what's in there? But with the track record so far, I don't know. A couple other ones. There was a Dusty Turbo Express, $250. If it's cleaned up and works. I think it's $250.
Yeah.
At this point in time. And then a Bubble Bobble 2 that had some sort of Famicom adapter on
the
bottom.
I think it was a Famicom adapter on the
bottom. And they said $500 for that. Is that accurate for a loose Bubble Bobble 2 this day and age?
I couldn't even tell.
Well, I'll look it up right now, or a certain NES Guide app could do it for you. But not even close. Okay. So the
Because I feel like we sold a perfect boxed complete one for about that maybe 6 months to a year ago.
That would sound reasonable for one that had the box. So let's see, $280 for a real one, $208, tons of repros, $340. Okay, it's not close to that amount, that price valuation. $346, $227. So we're, you know, if you average it out, we'll just say about $300.
Yeah. No, okay. I was going to say a boxed one, I think. The complete one went for about $500.
So do you see a danger in these wild valuations?
Yeah, like I said, this is what causes, when you look at something like Atari, it causes grandmas to go into their attic and see things worth, think that things are worth them. But it also, this is what causes the market to spike on things that didn't have that value before.
The issue with the Atari games in particular is that even if you wanted to get max value for the Atari 2600 games that aren't worth that amount of money, the market for Atari 2600 collector is probably 10% or less of an NES collector or right. A Sega Genesis collector.
So it's our pals at Atari age.
It's our pals at Atari age.
Hey, Atari age!
So when you're giving these wild valuations that, from my expertise, Renee, are off for 90% of these, that would even be for pie in the sky if you took your time to collate them, go through them, price them accordingly, and then throw them on eBay with high buy it nows and wait for people to pull the trigger. Not pricing to sell at a convention just to get rid of them, not selling them as a set to get rid of them quickly and recoup some money. The maximum dollar amount when you value video games is based upon usually buy it nows off of eBay that have went.
That's the environment that you're placing him on. Not a store environment necessarily, which could be higher or lower, but you could hold on to it. And it, but it also doesn't account for the time it's going to take for you to go through those individual games. So when he says...
Time is money.
When he says those 300 Atari games is worth $3,000 somehow at $10 a piece, any person that... Any collector that looks at a box of 300 Atari games might say, I'll give you $400 or $500 for that box. And a reasonable businessman might say, okay, take it. Especially if my investment into this whole unit is only $1,500. Now, I'm a third of the way recouping that cost.
Right, exactly.
You know what I mean? So there's a lot of problems with this.
Well, the other problem is, too, especially if you look at something like Atari, I've noticed two markets for Atari collecting right now. You have 15 and 16-year-old kids who think it's just kind of neat, who don't have the money to pay an inflated price on Atari games at, you know, 10, 15 bucks a piece. They're interested in it because they can get the games for $2, $3 a piece, a dollar. And then you have the people at Atari age who have the games that they want. So who are you moving them to?
And then the other, the end of it, to get the total valuation of the entire unit, he said, well, there's 30 more boxes there, like $150 each, that adds like $30,000, whatever the hell he said. We don't know what's in those boxes. We don't know if they're video games, because a lot of the other shit they showed were like VHS tapes, some of them, so we have no idea.
It could be more, but it could be less. I mean, it's a random guess.
It could be. So it's not to totally kill someone like Renee, who I think is not a good businessman from my experience, seeing him yell at little ladies looking at fucking industrial staplers and picking them out of their hands because they're not, you know, buying it fast enough. You've done that, Renee. Don't fucking deny that, because I was there. Besides that, though, I just don't think this is good to have wild valuations like this. I just don't.
We have a scumbag. Scumbag.
A scumbag?
Seller.
Talking seller. About a seller. Someone that sells something.
Who's scummy about it. Scummy about it.
And it's at a time period. And it's at a time
Of the week.
Which is 7 days.
7 days. Not a fortnight. Not a 14.
This would be a long echo.
This would be a long echo.
Echo. Of the week.
People are getting annoyed now.
All right.
So this scumbag seller of the week is Unique _ Souvenirs 7, Ian. And why they have Scumbag Seller of the Week?
Because they are selling Repro Super Nintendo and NES boxes. But they're only souvenirs. They're just, you know, souvenirs. Something you would totally find in a souvenir shop.
Alongside your mini Statue of Liberty.
Oh, I was going to say mini Eiffel Tower, but okay. We're on the same
page. I had a mini Statue of Liberty from 1986.
Nice. Very nice.
From the Bicentennial.
So these are great. Brand new Super Nintendo Entertainment System replacement box. Souvenir 1-to-1, not original. Same thing with the Nintendo Entertainment System replacement box. No styrofoam comes with the box. Great for display or storage of your old system. These boxes are in new mint condition and are hard to find. They're not hard to find if you can just print off more of them.
I always love when people say that.
Yeah, it's... No, the originals are hard to find.
Digital file rare. No, it's not.
No, it's not hard to find at all. I'm pretty sure I could go out on the internet right now and find it.
So when you look at these... By the way, it's $90 for these two souvenir boxes plus shipping.
That's a...
So when you look at them...
It's a steal.
I'm sure in person... We can tell the flaws of this a lot more easily. From first glance, it doesn't look awful, but then you look at like the Nintendo logo and you look at the spacing of the font and the letters. You see the logo, the oval.
Holy
Nintendo.
Shit!
So you look at the side of the Super Nintendo box next to good old Yoshi and Mario riding him. It looks awful there. So it's not even. It's good that it's not totally accurate. Or look at it on the NES control deck on the top left, the gray. That looks fucking painted on almost by hand. It looks that bad.
No, just the Nintendo logo alone, like...
But that's what's so weird, is because the other parts of it are just a pure scan. But that looks like it was custom, that part of it.
Yeah.
So, this isn't a one-to-one, like they say. But I'm glad, though, because it looks like horse shit. It looks awful.
Yeah, if that came into the store...
it's like that they pressed the space bar too many times when typing out Nintendo.
It's not even the right font, I don't think.
I don't... They couldn't find the Nintendo font.
It's not the right shade of gray?
Great for display or storage of your old system. How can you store your old system without the styrofoam in a box like this that...
I don't know if it even has the same quality. I don't know. What's interesting, though, is that this is the one of the only video game items this person is selling. When you click on their other items, it's sports memorabilia, patches, signed Draymond Green jersey of the Golden State Warriors, Nobel Prize souvenir medal in physics or chemistry, rare, USA, Sweden. Ian is tightening up because he knows how awful this is. The whole point is that I don't see how you can get into this business thinking it's a good idea to make counterfeit boxes for consoles that aren't good looking to begin with, but that cost probably more than going out and buying a box by itself.
Yes.
That's the other part. For $45, yes. I'm pretty sure I can find a control deck box without the styrofoam.
Yep.
For the NES.
Uh-huh.
So it's just a really... They sold one. They actually sold one.
Oh, my God.
So I don't know how you get into this business. I don't know if it's something you just do for fun and say, you know what? I think I can sell these. Please don't buy this. I don't know what I'd rather you do. I'd rather you spend money from another scumbag of the Cell of the Week that's more deserving even of this. But this is just...
Drugs.
Do drugs so that Nintendo logo looks correct, yeah, in your eyes.
Do the right drugs to make that Nintendo logo just breathe
just
a little.
Mesh. Yeah. Ian, any closing thoughts? And this is a pretty quick scumbag Cell of the Week. Oh, you want to get a Chris Christie signed Time magazine with his face on the cover saying "The Boss"? He's selling that too.
I heard even more. Now we're done with this.
This is some positive news following an unfortunate tragedy, the death of Carrie Fisher around Christmas that happened. So at the time I was postulating, as many of you probably were, about what to do about Carrie Fisher appearing in Star Wars Episode 9. Fortunately, before her passing, she had finished filming Episode 8, which is due out December of this year. By the time you hear this, I think the first trailer might be out because they're doing Star Wars Celebration in Orlando the weekend of April 15th. So they'll probably show it. But we were wondering, you know, what to do about Episode 9. Lucasfilm came out and said there was going to be no CG recreation out of respect for Carrie Fisher and her family. That seems sort of beyond the pale for them to do that. They don't want to make it like a, you know, to simplify it into like a Jar Jar Binks sort of situation. But that's not what they wanted to do. They felt that would not be doing a service to Carrie Fisher's legacy and her memory. But they came to an agreement, according to Fisher's brother, Todd Fisher. Princess Leia will appear in Episode 9 via Carrie Fisher footage that they shot and didn't use for, I'm guessing, Episode 7 and 8. Quote-unquote recent footage. So that's good news, that we're going to have some sort of closure to the character and at least see this beloved, iconic character in the last Star Wars movie to feature her, and not just have Princess Leia written out, which I thought, or General Leia, now, and I thought like an off-screen explosion, or they explain her she's not there, or they go to the J.J. Abrams Star Trek route and have Spock, you know, find out he dies in the beginning of the third movie and there's a funeral, which all could have been a path you could have went, would have probably pissed off people. Whatever decision you made, you would have pissed off one form of the fan base or other to say, leave it alone, respect her memory, don't have her in it at all. Or no, you respect her by respecting the story and what she would have wanted. So it's a happy medium, I guess, if you can say that, where if you have footage of her, I don't know what locations you took with her. I don't know if you're going to do CG with the background, you know, some sort of place her against green screen and CG in different backgrounds for her. I'm not sure what dialogue she's recorded, Carrie Fisher, already, that you could recycle and use again for Episode 9. I have no idea. Obviously, they're going to have to rewrite some of that for Episode 9. So the decision that was made, because Todd Fisher said, how do you take her out of it? The answer is you don't. She's as much a part of it as anything. I think her presence now is even more powerful than it was. Like Obi-Wan, when the saber cuts him down, he becomes more powerful. I feel like that's what's happened with Carrie. I think the legacy should continue. And I think a lot of us thought that it should continue in some capacity as well. It's just that, again, there was no simple answer. It's not like she even, you know, if she had finished like three quarters filming episode 9 and you could have like finished, you know, with some little CG or trickery or body doubles like they did with Philip Seymour Hoffman in that last Hunger Games where he had filmed part of it but not all of it. I think most of us would have been okay with that. It would have been it would not have been disrespect. It would have been like, well, you know, it was filmed. They got to do a little bit more. They got to just use some, you know, magic and trickery of film, you know, in order to complete it. I think we would have been fine, and that we would have thought that was respectable. But when you start from scratch, it's tougher to do that. I mean, remember, like for Fast and the Furious 7, they basically shut down production for like, you know, 6 to 8 months before they had to rewrite a chunk of it and figure out how to replace the rest of Paul Walker's performance. You know, so this way, I think it's cleaner if you know going in, okay, we're not going to see, you know, her perform part of it and then guess, well, is that her? Is that a body double? You know now that this was all pre-filmed. I don't know what sort of magic they're going to do with green screen or CG in order to put her in different backgrounds or talk to someone. I have no idea. But at least this is really her in the film. And that at least, it'll bring warmth to my heart at least a little bit. I think everyone watching will be like, okay, we're not being tricked with. This is Carrie Fisher being on film. This is the last we're going to see her. Maybe they won't be able to do as much as they would have wanted to, obviously, if they had her to film episode 9. But she can go out in a nice way, I think. And I think that's good for us Star Wars fans, and I think fans of Carrie Fisher in general. Here's a Q&A question. This is from Kevin Rodriguez. What do collectors do once they have gotten most of what they want? I've noticed games at my local store there for months now. Is retro collecting slowing down? It's tough to gauge entirely, but I will say this. For a long while, the demand of retro gamers in terms of the supply out there was not being kept up. Therefore, the glut of sellers getting into the market and resellers and people establishing stores and eBay stores, that filled the hole. And that was good because then you had people finding the games, delivering the games to these people, probably at a much quicker rate. That allowed the hobby to expand. The problem, though, I think the past probably 3 years, is that the number of sellers proportionally now has outpaced the number of new collectors getting into retro video games and players. So when you go to a convention now, as Ian pointed out before and I've brought up, is that when you see multiple sellers with these same rare games for sale and they don't move the entire weekend, that's not a good sign for the hobby, and it's not a good sign that the demand now could be slipping versus the price point. So obviously there could be a correction in the market. That's the first thing that can happen in a situation like this. So if you have someone, for example, when you say that your local store has had the same games for months and months, they're going to have to lower the price eventually. If they don't want to take the time to put the game online and put like a high buy it now and wait there forever for it to sell at the price they want it to sell, and you know they have overhead, they have employees to pay, they have a lease on the area, etc. They have to make money. They have to sell games. This isn't new merchandise that, you know, if it doesn't move, you wholesale it, you take a smaller loss. A lot of times when these retro stores get going, they have to pay. If they have to pay a lot for the games coming in, that means they have to make more to keep the same margin. And that's tougher when it's something like a used games where the price fluctuation can be massive. So if there's a rare game that comes in, say it's, I don't know, it's like Bubble Bath Bay, it's an Asian game. Say that walks through the door, okay? And they say that, okay, online it's going for, like, say, $1,100, $1,200. They might be willing to pay then a little bit more if they know it's going to sell, or if they think it's going to sell, they'll pay like $700 for it, saying, okay, I'll make a $500 profit. But what if there's not a lot of people out there in the market for $1,200 Bubble Bath Babes? What if that's sitting in the store now for a long time? That means then you're going to have to put it on eBay, and then you're going to be losing 15% right there, so that $1,200 becomes $1,000 only. Or you lower the price locally, and so your profit margin goes down, or it doesn't sell. I mean, those are really your options. So look at it at a large game like that. But now, what if you take that same philosophy and apply it to the mid-range games, like a Contra? So I don't even know what a Contra is going for right now. Let me look that up right now. All right, Contra NES. I always like to use Contra as an example because it's a very common game. but it still goes for money. So, you know, so, right, so it's trending at $32 on eBay. One's $28. Buy it now. Let's see. You can buy it, you can buy it for like under $30 a Contra. So that's probably peaked. Probably peaked. Okay? So, but you still want that for your store. For the games that are coming in, it'll get to a point where the seller will have to take a more and more of a risk to buy that inventory, because those games won't move as quickly as they used to. So then what happens then? Confidence then fades, and then you might have some sellers back out. And they might be doing that right now. It's happened at my flea market, where there used to be, I say 3 years ago, 4 years ago, it peaked, where every week you had 5 to 6 retro game sellers. Because at the time, it was easier to find the stock, and there probably wasn't as many people hunting. But that's when they knew, like, okay, there's still a proliferation of games out there. We can get into it and make money. Okay? So that's what they did. But what they quickly found was, at that location, since they all had the same games, similar inventory, and they all eBay-type prices or similar prices, the market couldn't sustain the number of sellers in that location. So if you extrapolate that to, say, eBay or the larger United States or the retro gaming hobby at large, I think we're approaching that where you have as many sellers as we're ever going to need for retro game collecting. We don't need any more sellers. There's big sellers like Lukey Games out there, Sosa Games, that are huge enterprises. They get games by the truckload. We don't need more of them. There's so many mom and pop eBay sellers out there now. So if the collectors get the games they want, like someone like me, or even someone who's been collecting for 3-4 years, and in that time has gotten even 80% of the games they want, there's not as many people rising up through the ranks to continue that cycle so that the sellers can make their money to pay a high amount for games that could be common, like a Contra again, to continue that cycle to keep it going. I think we're at that point where the final turn might have already occurred. Not saying there's going to be a crash, but what I'm saying is those sellers might now discover that, wow, that Earthbound I have, I could have sold it in a week 4 years ago. Now that Earthbound at $190, I got to hold on to that Earthbound for like 6 months before I have to sell it. So now it becomes a waiting game. Does the buyer then just say, all right, they're going to have to lower the price at some point. They have to move that game. Or is the seller going to have to use more energy to get the price that they want to, quote unquote, protect their investment? That's where I think we are heading. Or we're already there at this point. Does that make sense? Earthbound, I can do $155 buy it now, our best offer. That was a $250 game a few years ago, down to $155. That's just one example. Wild Guns has gone down in price. And the only reason I know this is because I've been looking at Super Nintendo games lately. But Kevin, that was a great question. I would ask your local store. Hey, if you still have, you know, the same, you know, 200 NES games a year from now, what would you do? Would you put them on eBay and get whatever you can get? Or would you hold out hope that with you know, I'm paying for electricity and employees and lease, and, you know, the lease for of my rent. What are you going to do at that point if this becomes a larger issue? I don't know. Thank you so much for listening to this CU podcast. Please subscribe if you haven't already on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Podbean, or your platform of choice. You could rate the podcast or leave a comment that helps give it a boost in the good old algorithms. And if you want to directly support Ian and I, it's patreon.com/CU podcast. If you want to advertise or sponsor the CU podcast, please shoot an email to CUpodcast@thepunkeffect.com. I'll get back to you there. I will be at Retropalooza Houston, which is actually in Pasadena. That is the weekend of April 22nd and 23rd. That's at Retropalooza Houston. RetroSpillMessen.com. I will also be at RetroSpillMessen, and that will be May 20th and 21st, and that's in Sandefjord, Norway. Go to RetroSpillMessen.no for more information there. I got the Ultimate NES guide out, the book and the app. Go to UltimateNES.com, and you can check out the book there, and that's going strong. I also have the app, iOS.UltimateNES.com. If you have an Apple device or if you have an Android device, you can check it out, screenshots and information at droid.UltimateNES.com. And I also have my secondary podcast now, which is the Not So Common podcast. It's sort of turned into an interview show. I've interviewed Frank, Mark Busser from Classic Game Room, Norm the Gaming Historian, Mike Matei from Sid and Massacre, Andre Meadows of Black Nerd Comedy, and more. And coming up soon will be Brent Black, a.k.a. Brennel Floss. So there you go, guys. I hope you had fun. Ian toughed it out for a good chunk of this. Have a great weekend, or whatever day of the week it is for you. Have a great Thursday or Tuesday, or, you know, I always said Tuesday was the worst day of the week, and I still hold to that. Wednesday is my favorite day of the week. I don't know why. And today's Wednesday. I'm recording on a Wednesday. Maybe that's why. I'm rambling. I'll see you later.